time.
C. C is for...
Cauliflower.
Confusion. Creation.
Pickle. K for...
Kitten.
Camp.
C. Wait. U. Unbearable.
U is for underground.
Oh, yeah.
Umbrella.
T. Trite.
Tremendous.
Torment.
Tire.
C. K.
I can't think of a U one. T.
T.
F is for famous.
Fun. Fumble. M is for...
The following is a previously broadcast program.
Good evening. You're listening to Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM and at CKUT.ca, the show about theater on the radio. From drama to musicals to burlesque to comedy and everything in between. I'm your host, Sarah Day, recording from home on November 26th, 2020. On tonight's show, my guests, Quincy Armorer, Artistic Director at Black Theater Workshop on the company's 50th year.
I wanted to make sure that this season was going to be a reflection of both of those things, that we were able to honor our legacy and history by looking back. But at the same time, I think it's also really important to make sure that we're like, okay, we've gotten to this point, we've made it to 50 years, where is the company going to be going moving forward?
Karine Kerr-Gillespie, bringing the Metas to your home this weekend.
There is kind of a groundwork has been laid in previous seasons, and there's a wheel that turns every year, so this time we just had to figure out the wheel and figure out a little bit differently how we were going to approach it.
And actor and director Terrence Bowman reuniting for a Die Hard Christmas virtually.
We get so many people who, well, when we used to do shows live, who would show up and, like, they know all the lines, they know all the characters, they know all that, and that's because they watch it every year.
Before we begin, a few updates. Just before last week's show, the whole of Quebec got word of what the government has in store for the next 2 months or so. 4 days of visiting allowed at Christmas, but in addition, arts venues, cinemas, museums, as well as restaurants and gyms will have to wait until January 11th to reopen, which means no live arts for the time being, at least in person. And since reopening has been pushed back already since the end of October, who knows if things will be back to normal in the new year. The guests I spoke with last week, Heather Ma of Pomegranate and Sophie G and Shadia Kikonjo of Habibi's Angels, are not performing on stage this week as planned. I corresponded with Heather the day after the announcement, and she had this to say about the news. I was prepared for this. We all have to be. We've done good work and used our time in the theater well. A very positive spin coming from Heather, and I hope that I'll be able to see Pomegranate, her solo show, at some point in the future. But stay tuned until the end of Upstage tonight, and I'll tell you how you can still catch Habibi's Angels very soon. In other news, something nice to share, Infinitheater's big Write on Cue contest winner has just been announced. Over 40 plays were submitted this year, and the top playwriting prize, The Kevin, goes to Vierge by Rachel Matumbo. It's about four Congolese Canadian teenage girls who are struggling with their sexuality while also saving themselves for marriage. This is the first full-length play Rachel has completed. She is a Dora Award-winning actor and writer, a graduate of the John Abbott Drama Program, as well as the National Theatre School. Her play, Vierge, was developed at the Emerging Playwrights Unit at Toronto's Factory Theatre. The jury said that the story makes you laugh and cry, sometimes on the same page, and that Rachel is one of the most exciting and original voices to come out of Canadian theaters in many years. Rachel wins a purse of $5,000, supposedly the biggest literary prize in Quebec. And I must mention, the award is named for Kevin Tierney, the film producer who was a longtime supporter and board member at Infinitheater. Honorable mentions go to The Trial of William Shakespeare by Alex Posh-Golden and Beloved by Arthur Holden. For more information about the prize and the winner, visit infinitheater.com. And there is also some theater to look forward to next month. Siegel Center is indeed going ahead with its presentation of Underneath the Lintel, a first-ever co-production with Théâtre du Nouveau Monde. The show was first presented in French at TNM last September, with live and home audiences tuning in. I myself watched it from my couch. Emmanuel Schwartz returns, this time en anglais, as a librarian who is trying to figure out why a book return came in late. And not just a few days late, but 133 years overdue. It's a one-man show that travels all over the world, touching on matters of both history, very recent, and very ancient. Glenn Berger wrote and starred in the original performance in New York City, which was itself delayed by a month in the wake of the September 11th attacks. Plans at the Siegel were this December to have a limited audience in person as well as a live stream. But this week, the theater has unveiled plans to do 3 live streams and 1 weekend, Saturday, December 12th at 8, Sunday, December 13th at 1 and 7 p.m. Tickets are now on sale, $36 per household. And on Sunday, December 6th, I'll be taking part in the Sunday at the Siegel talk about the show. We haven't had one in months. I'm very excited about this. Find out more about Underneath the Lintel at siegelcenter.org. So, some sad news and then some very good news. On to tonight's interviews. The Montreal English Theatre Awards are now in its 8th year, a chance for the theatre community to recognize and highlight excellence on stage and backstage. Usually it would be a Sunday night spectacular, taking place at the likes of the Rialto or Monument National, with drinks and people dressed to the nines. This weekend, the awards are happening, but virtually, even though just about half of the theatre season was cancelled due to COVID-19 restrictions. 17 productions were registered for the Metas, and 18 awards will be given out on Sunday, 16 decided by a jury and 2 prizes nominated by the community. I called up Karine Kerr-Gillespie, the co-chair of the METAC, or Organizing Committee. She is also the general manager of the festival Accès Asie. Karine let me in on plans to keep the awards on track in a very special year. Good evening, Karine. Welcome back to Upstage. How have you been these past few months?
I've been okay. I think that's the best answer I can give about 2020.
Yeah, I think that's totally fair. Absolutely. Big thing coming up this weekend, the METAS, Montreal English Theatre Awards. You are the co-chair of the committee. When did you guys start, you know, talking amongst yourselves about what this year was going to look like? Was there a possibility of even skipping the ceremony this year?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think we started, I think right away, as soon as the pandemic was announced, we had like a meeting already planned, and then we sort of had to take some time to think about what we were going to do. And yeah, for sure, I think it was a possibility at some point. I don't think we ever entertained it for very long to just skip the ceremony entirely. But we knew that we had to wait and see what was going to happen, because at mid-March, we didn't know how long this was going to last. Like, we didn't know that come November, we would still be in a red zone. So it was a little bit harder to plan this year. This is the 8th ceremony, so there is kind of a groundwork has been laid in previous seasons, and there's a wheel that turns every year. So this time we just had to throw out the wheel and figure out a little bit differently how we were going to approach it.
Right, and to throw out the wheel, I guess throwing out the usual stuff. I mean, normally it's kind of a bit of a glitzy evening. There's a lot of work that you guys put into making it an entertaining show, right? There's the musical numbers. There'll be kind of some performances. Sometimes there's like special ways that you present things. When you're talking about what it was going to look like virtually, what kind of conversations were you having about what it was going to look like?
Yeah, that was difficult, because when we decided to do it virtually, that was one of the issues that we had, and I think that everyone has when they consider transforming their art to a visual, like a online virtual plane, to figure out how that was going to be. Were we still going to do it live, or could we do pre-recording? But then, you know, theater is a live art form, so we really wanted to keep that aspect of liveness. So that's how we ended up deciding to do it on basically like a soundstage and live streaming the hosts, but really cutting down on the rest of the people that are normally on stage that you see at the ceremony. So there won't be any presenters. The hosts are handling kind of everything that you're gonna see. But then we also wanted to have the community be a part of it, because that's a really big aspect of the ceremony, that everybody gets together and we have a good time. So we're still going to be able to bring up recipients on the screen. They're going to be like backstage in a virtual space, and then be able to be put on the screen when the category is announced. And when the recipient is announced, they'll also be able to give their normal speech that they would have done on stage normally.
So
we had to discuss how that was going to work technically, because obviously none of us knew how to do any of that at the beginning of the year. So we had to learn as we went. And Stephen McLean Rogers, who's our ceremony liaison, has been working really hard in understanding all that technical aspect. And like the nominee announcement that we had in September was kind of like a trial run for us, because it was the first time that we were doing something live.
Because you streamed you did do it live, right?
Yes, but it was only with us. So it was a little bit easier. Like it was a good first step, because the nominee announcement is always done by the MITAC.
Mm-hmm.
So it was kind of easier to handle amongst ourselves, and then figure out what worked, what didn't, and then go forward with the ceremony.
Speaking with Karine Kergaletsby, who is the co-chair of the MITAC, the committee organizing the METAs every year. So who's going to be your presenter? Who will be, and where are they going to be in your virtual presenting space?
So our two hosts are Justin Johnson and Adam Capriolo, and they're going to be in the Jordy space. Like, they have a new space.
Yes, in Little Italy.
Yes, exactly. So they have a space where they're doing their own play tour, and we're renting your space to do the same. So that room will have very few people in it compared to the usual stage. It will only have like a handful of people who are filming those two hosts, and there will be an integration of pre-recorded videos as well for some skits and some fun to be able to have a laugh, because I think everybody needs a little bit of a laugh right now.
A little, to break some of the, not the tension, maybe there'll be some nerve-wracked nominees there, but just to make it entertaining. Now, the season's been pretty truncated because everything came to a crashing halt in March, and normally you'd be looking at things that started in the fall all the way until, I guess, I'm not sure when the official ending date would be, but I guess the summertime of the, right?
End of August, I think the season.
So what do you do with that? What kind of decisions do you have to make considering so many shows got canceled? Do you just pull from the shows that were managed to be staged between September and beginning of March?
That's exactly what happened. It was very hard because we knew that so many people were affected by this and had shows canceled, and they're heartbroken and put so much effort into something that never saw the light. But at the same time, we still had like 6 months of shows that did happen. So if we were to have just canceled everything, it would have taken away from those productions, from those people. But then if we wanted to do it in a way that was still respectful to the community who had so much taken away from them this year. So the jury still worked in the same way that they always do. So they evaluated all the categories based on the three first quarters of the year, because they sort of evaluate the play by quarters. So the last quarter, which was the summer show, had nothing. So they still voted in the same way. There was just a little bit less option, I would say, than usual. Like, they had a bigger pool normally. But they still had enough to make a critical decision over what happened. And the goal of the Metas is really to celebrate outstanding, and there was still outstanding work that had happened. So we really wanted to be able to include it and to celebrate it with an award ceremony.
Yeah. And I wonder, I mean, I don't imagine there being like a little asterisk if somebody puts like that they've won for the 2019-2020 season, like asterisk only half the season, you know, we only got through half the season, right? But I think it's important, as you said, like to still honor what did happen, even though it's like your pool of material or of outstanding work is so much more limited, but it doesn't mean that there wasn't still excellent stuff happening between September and March, and that still deserves kind of a plaudit. What are you feeling about your committee, like being able to pull this together in a time where people can't get together? You've had to, as you were saying, learn all about putting stuff online. What's the feeling? Are you guys proud of what you've done? Are you nervous about with this coming up on Sunday?
I think a little bit of both. It's definitely been an adjustment because so we've been, you know, having all of our meetings over Zoom like everybody else. But usually, you know, we try to make our committee meeting a little bit more fun, more convivial. Like we have food, we bring wine sometimes because we're all volunteers and it's like we do a lot of work, but we also want to feel like it's also our getting together. So that was taken away. So that's really unfortunate, but I'm really proud and happy of all the committee members who have given so much of their time and their commitment has not faltered. Everybody was really keen to get something together and give the community something to look forward to and have a great night. So hopefully people will be happy.
I'm absolutely sure that they will be happy. Is there something that you're looking forward to in particular?
It's always the recipients, like the reactions. I think that's always fun, and because there is a chance to see that live, normally when you're in the audience at like the Monument National, you can't really see necessarily the people around you so well because it's such a big room and we have like up to 400 guests. But we're going to get to do a little bit of like the Oscar type thing where you put up the live feed from the nominees on the screen. So I'm really looking forward to getting to see that reaction the second that somebody learns that they've received the meta for this category this year. You know, I think that's going to be a really fun plus that can happen because it's a virtual ceremony.
And also the fact that people will be in the comfort of home maybe will be nice as well. People will be comfortable at home. Sorry, that's a totally random thought. The two awards that I always look forward to are your Unsung Hero Awards, and also the award which celebrates diversity. And so did you get a good amount of nominations for that? Because that is where people actually put suggestions forward, right?
Yes, that's community nominated. Mm-hmm. So that didn't, like, COVID didn't have an impact on that because people were still able to send in their own nominations. And yes, we got quite a few. I think on the contrary, maybe people had more time to send in nominations this year. But yeah, we had great, great possibilities this year. And I know the committees had trouble picking one out of them. So
I always
can't give anything away. But.
No. I know it's a secret right until the last minute. I always look forward to that one because it's always nice to hear the stories that are there behind people that are doing interesting work. I mean, that's the whole point of the Unsung Hero Award, but also the Diversity Award, because people can put forward names. I always look forward to hearing those stories. So I'm really glad that that's included this year as well. Well, Kevin, thank you so much for taking the time. Break a leg for Sunday. I hope that the next couple of days of finishing touches go smoothly.
Well, thank you. I hope so too. I think it's going to be great.
Awesome. Looking forward to it. Thank you so much, Karin.
Thank you.
That was Karin Kerr-Gillespie, the co-chair of the METAC, or Organizing Committee. The Montreal English Theatre Awards will be revealed this Sunday evening. You can follow online at the META's YouTube channel and visit their website, metas.ca, METAS.ca. I'm Sarah DeA, and you're listening to Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM and at CKUT.ca, coming to you from my home yet again this week. Still to come, how to see some of Montreal's funniest women in one place, coming together to alleviate one of the most difficult side effects of the pandemic. Black Theater Workshop has just revealed the plans for its 50th anniversary season, and despite the pandemic, they are going to be very busy. From readings to virtual shows and its annual Vision Awards, to mentoring and showcasing up-and-coming artists, as well as a chance to share the follow-up to a play from 5 years ago with the rest of Canada. At a time of even greater awareness and activism about Black life and culture, the company is poised for another stellar year. But did you know Black Theatre Workshop is the longest-running Black theatre company in the whole country? Artistic director Quincy Armorer spoke to me earlier this week about its origins. Good evening, Quincy. Welcome back to Upstage. Thank you so much for taking the time.
It's my pleasure, Sarah. Nice to be here.
And a big congratulations on the 50th anniversary, which...
Thank you.
We talked about it a little bit last time you were on to speak about George, but now your Furl calendar is out. You've launched your season. What was important, not every head of a theater company gets to plan a 50th season, right? So when you were talking with your team about what needed to be part of, you know, celebrating 50 years, what were you looking to accomplish?
It's a great question. I think we were looking to do a couple of things. I mean, obviously, to be celebrating such a milestone, 50th anniversary, is a big thing, and it makes you become very reflective and to think about, you know, where the company is and where you want to go. And that's kind of where things landed for me. I wanted to make sure that this season was going to be a reflection of both of those things, that we were able to honor our legacy and history by looking back. But at the same time, I think it's also really important to make sure that we're like, okay, we've gotten to this point. We've made it to 50 years. Where is the company going to be going moving forward? And so that I wanted to make sure we didn't just rest on the past and become too reflective without actually making a stance or a clear vision for where the company is going to be going into the future. So I wanted to make sure that we covered a little bit of both of those things. And I hope that we'll be able to actually do that. You know, there's going to be some celebratory things, talking to some of the people that have been a part of the company back in the 90s, 80s, 70s, but also to make sure that we're looking for where the company is heading as well.
I like that. Looking back, but also looking forward. It's important. Mm-hmm. Would you mind telling us, like, looking a bit back and telling us about the origins of the company?
Sure. I mean, it's 50 years now. So back in Black Theatre Workshop, as we know it, is 50 years, but it sort of had its beginnings even a little bit before that. It was founded really as a part of a drama club or drama committee within the Trinidad and Tobago Association of Montreal. So the origins of the company are very much rooted in Caribbean culture and West Indian culture, Trinidad and Tobago specifically. And then over the course of many years, it's just grown and expanded to encompass, you know, the full Black diaspora, not just the Caribbean culture, but, you know, Black Caribbean and North American and European and African culture as well. So we really have run the gamut to just be, you know, I think it was, you know, the back in the days, people like Clarence Bain, who's still on our board of directors, believe it or not,
who's wow.
One of the founders. Yeah, it's incredible. I'm so impressed with this gentleman and honored to know him. But, you know, they really wanted to make sure that the stories of the culture of West Indian Black folk in Montreal were being present on stage, because they just weren't. And so that really is the nucleus for Black Theatre Workshop. Over the course of the years, as I mentioned, you know, we've encompassed a lot more than that. But to me, that speaks to the longevity of the company and to the passion and dedication of those who were a part of the organization beforehand. I think it's really important to acknowledge that a company doesn't exist for 50 years if it's not for many, many, many dedicated and passionate individuals who give so much to make sure that it does have that longevity. So I'm honored to stand on the shoulders of so many artists and individuals who came beforehand, who played a role in making BTW what it is. And I'm excited right now to see where the company's going to go. We have some exciting things in store, lots to celebrate.
And lots to be proud of. So it's a really exciting time for us at Black Theatre Workshop right now.
It most definitely is. Speaking with Artistic Director Quincy Armorer at Black Theatre Workshop 50th season, the calendar is out now. And you have a lot of things coming up, first of which is something coming up in December, part of your Discovery series. Can you tell me about Sanctuary?
Sanctuary is our play reading series, our Discovery series, and it's a new play that's written by our newly appointed artistic associate, Lydie Dubuisson, who I'm very excited to have on our team. And this is a new play. We did a stage reading of her other play, Quiet, a couple of years ago, I think it was. And so this is another piece of hers that she's been working on for quite some time. And I'm really excited to bring it to the stage. Lydie is a multidisciplinary artist. You know, she's an alumnus of our artist mentorship program. And she's an emerging director as well. So it's really nice to be able to help foster her, not only in terms of direction, but as a writer. So this is a really, really lovely play. And it centers around one character who's just sort of, you know, going through a little bit of an inner struggle and taking sanctuary in her church, sort of find her path and find her faith, which I think is a really lovely message, particularly with everything that's going on right now in the world. So we're really excited to share this piece. It's going to be a virtual reading on Friday, December the 11th. That's scheduled right now for 2:00 in the afternoon. So we're hoping that people will join us on our Facebook page, because that's where we're going to be doing a live stream.
What kind of response are you getting from the members of the BTW community and the larger Black community in Montreal as you were kind of, you know, hitting this amazing anniversary, 50 years? Are people coming forward with memories? Are you hearing, thoughts from people?
They are. I mean, it's a little bit tricky because, you know, obviously with COVID and the pandemic, we've lost a little bit of that connection with our public a little bit. We're not as active as we have been.
Because normally you'd be doing events, and that would be a fantastic opportunity. Everybody knows who Quincy Armor is, and that would be a good opportunity where people would probably just be coming up to you and kind of saying, hey, like just great job or whatnot, or sending feedback, right, in person. But that's not happening.
It's not happening in that way, but we have gotten some wonderful messages from people who have reached out to us either, you know, through social media or via email to let us know that they're thinking of us and that they're really proud and happy to see that we've made it to where we are. And to me, that's one of the things about Black Theatre Workshop. It really did have its roots as a community organization, and that facet of the company is still around. People feel a sense of ownership and connection to Black Theatre Workshop, and I'm really proud of that. So we've gotten some lovely messages from people who are celebrating with us from afar, unfortunately. But to me, that speaks to the power of this organization. There's something about Black Theatre Workshop that brings communities together. You know, when we have our shows, particularly those Sunday matinees that we would have, those post-church going Sunday matinees where people would come together and they would celebrate together at a Black Theatre Workshop show. Like, that's a part of the heart of this company. It's what makes me so proud to be a part of it. So that's still happening, perhaps not as much as it would be if it weren't for a global pandemic that we're all facing. But I'm really encouraged by the fact that our community is still making an effort to reach out to us and to let us know how important we are to them. That means a lot.
I know we were just talking about the calendar there. We were discussing the first event, which is coming up December 11th. And if it's okay with you to go back to the calendar, because there is one thing happening in a couple months from now that really intrigued me. You're going to be taking part in Black and Blue Matters, a series with the National Arts Center, which is really cool. I'm not sure how it works. So it's a Black Theatre Workshop production, but it's presented by the NAC. And it's going, I think you're planning to do this virtually. Can you tell me about this particular presentation?
Yeah, for sure. This is a new initiative by the National Arts Center called Grand Act of Theater. And it's something that they started to put some focus on live performance during the pandemic. And they invited 11 performing arts organizations from across the country to participate. So we're really, really honored to be one of 11 companies that are taking part in this. And we, the piece that we chose to do was an excerpt of the upcoming production of Black and Blue Matters by Amari Newton, that's directed by Diane Roberts. It was supposed to originally be done on Thanksgiving weekend, but then once Montreal became a COVID red zone, we were forced to cancel. So it was one of those things where we could do theater the way that we wanted to, but we had this opportunity to do this live, socially distanced, outdoor performance, but then we couldn't do that either. All this to say that it's been postponed. We're going to be doing it in the spring, either in April or in May of 2021. And what it is a rap battle. This piece was a follow-up piece to Sal Capone, The Lamentable Tragedy Of by Amari Newton that we produced back in 2013. This is the follow-up piece to that. And this excerpt is a rap battle between two of the characters, Samir Frederick, who is a black youth who was shot by a police officer, and David Harrison, the white police officer who shot him. So it very much speaks to the violence that the black community is facing at the hands of law enforcement, to the Black Lives Matter movements. It's a very current, unfortunately, in many ways, a very current piece in that regard. So I'm really excited that it's still going to be able to have some form of presentation in spite of the fact that it was canceled when we were supposed to do it. And then the full production of Black and Blue Matters was supposed to be in this 50th season, but we've had to postpone it. So we're looking to present the full production in season 51 and the 2021-22 season.
Fantastic. So people who saw the story of Sal Capone way back when, it seems so much more recent than then, but 2013, wow.
Yeah.
If you had seen that, this is kind of a continuing thread. It's also just so interesting to me because the topic of violence against people of color by the police has become, as you said, so at the forefront right now, but you've been telling these stories for years. is there a feeling within your community that it's like, well, everyone's kind of coming around to seeing this issue for what it is, but we've been talking about it for so long and living through it?
Yeah, I mean, it's very much that, you know. I mean, Black Lives Matter is definitely a thing that's being talked about right now, and as you know, it rightfully should. But the way that I've been talking about this is that, you know, that's perhaps what it's called right now, and the movement mm-hmm. now has a branding. But to organizations like Black Theater Workshop and to the many Black communities, we've been fighting for and arguing for and for Black Lives Matter for a very, very long time now. We just didn't used to call it that. But it now has a name, it now has a title, there's now a specific movement associated with it. So in many ways, we're still doing the same work that we have been doing for a very, very long time. It just now has a name and a title that we can give to it. But all this to say that it's really important to us to make sure that the stories that we tell at Black Theater Workshop speak to what is important to our communities in the here and now. And in many ways, that has changed and evolved over 50 years. And in many other ways, it's exactly the same,
yeah.
Which is a really interesting thing to reflect upon. You know, as far as we have come as a society, as a people, as a species, we still have so much further to go. That's something that never ceases to impress or surprise me as time goes on. But it's really important, I think, for us to take a moment and reflect upon these things to see that, yes, Black Lives do matter and that these stories are important. And we're going to keep doing what we're doing. But what's really great is that I think there's a little bit more attention and focus on the importance of the communities and the importance of the stories that companies like Black Lives Workshop are telling. And that's a really good thing. You know, that's the light at the end of the tunnel, or, you know, to use maybe a bad cliche, of the icing on the cake, but I think there's something to be said for the fact that there's now appropriate amount of focus and attention being put on the Black Lives Matter movement, and I don't want to make sure that Black Theater Workshop and our communities take advantage of the fact that this is important right now, and people are taking notice.
It's so fitting that you touched on this, because I wanted to ask about how the stories and the themes have changed over time and how they haven't changed. So in the first season of Black Theater Workshop, let's say, or the second, third season, you know, were these themes still, were they, was that what was au courant at the time and important to audiences then as well?
Yeah, I mean, perhaps in a little bit different ways, right? Because the roots of Black Theatre Workshop were very much in the West Indian community as a part of the Trinidad and Tobago Association of Montreal. So it had a very specific and to a degree national focus, I guess, is one way of putting it. And that's evolved and expanded over the years to be a little bit more wider and encompassing of a more of the diaspora. But at the same time, at its heart, at its root, those stories are still the same. Back then, you know, people like Clarence Bain and his contemporaries were wanting to make sure that the things that were important to Black communities, and in his case, it was, you know, Black communities mm-hmm. from the Caribbean in particular, but the need to make sure that our stories, our histories, the things that were important to us were communicated and represented on stages in Montreal. In that regard, things haven't changed. That still needs to be given focus and priority. So that's, for me, where the things haven't, I don't want to say that they haven't changed, but the importance is still there. That's something that hasn't diminished, the importance of making sure that our communities, our lives, our stories, our people, our artists are represented in the work that we do, represented in Montreal and Canada's arts community. That's still the same, for sure.
Quincy, I wanted to ask you a personal question, which is about how you first came to BTW, but also if there was any show in particular that has stood out as like maybe something that you did that was a highlight for you, or something you saw as an audience member that really stood out from the past couple of years?
Oh, wow. What a lovely, lovely question, Sarah. You know, I think I'm a Montrealer. I'm born and raised here, and I'm a theater guy, and I'm Black. So BTW has always been, but all this to say that BTW has always been a part of my ambition. You know, I've known about the company since I was a teenager, and I've always wanted to be a part of it. And in terms of productions that have, you know, that I've seen or that have been significant to me, I mean, I'll always go back to as a performer. 5 years ago, we did The Adventures of a Black Girl in Search of God by Janet Sears. This was a National Arts Center and Centaur Theater co-production in association with Black Theater Workshop, and I had the privilege of being in the cast of this show. And it was unlike any production I had ever been a part of, ever, in my life until then. I still talk about the fact that as a performer, as a theater artist, there is Quincy Armour before August 25th, 2015, which was the first day of rehearsals for Adventures, and then there's Quincy Armour after. Because that production changed. It changed me. It changed who I am as a person. It changed who I am as an actor, as a theater professional. It was so significant because we were telling such an important story. It's the first time I had been involved in a production that had so many Black artists involved together on stage. And Janet Sears, and the way that she brought art and our culture into the storytelling was just unlike anything I had ever been seen or been a part of before. So in terms of productions that have been very significant in my life, that's probably the one, The Adventures of a Black Girl in Search of God by Janet Sears, definitely.
So beautifully said, Quincy. And I just wanted to recall, you were something like 20 people at least on stage, right?
22 in that cast. Yeah, it was fantastic. Like a chorus of 14 people.
Yeah.
Oh, we just, and it was just a remarkable experience. Like we got on like a house on fire. Mm-hmm. Everybody understood the significance of what was happening in that production, you know, and it wasn't an all-Black cast. cast. It was very diverse, mostly Black, but, you know, a lot of artists who were non-Black as well. But everybody understood the importance and the significance of what was happening in that production, in that room, in those rehearsals, and in that process. It was very, very remarkable.
And I remember you being front and center, I believe. You played the partner of the main character. Am I recalling that correctly?
Yeah, that's right. Lucinda Davis played Rainey, and I played Pastor Michael. I played her ex-husband in the show. Yeah.
That play has stuck with me mostly. I recall the, the parents, the elderly people who were in their off hours committing some forms of...
In the show, they were called the Lots of Soap Gang.
Yeah. Committing acts of vigilantism, that their storyline was what always stuck with me from there. It was so, such a delightfully strange and subversive plot line coming through, but for older actors as well. And but the sheer size of all those people on stage was really truly breathtaking. And it's very interesting to hear it from your perspective and how that's shaped you as an artist. As an artist, do you feel like it changed you? You gave a reason, but is it because it changed maybe or solidified what kind of stories you wanted to tell?
In part, it definitely. Opened my eyes into the kinds of stories that I want to tell as a performer, and the stories that are important to me. I've been a performer and I've had a very successful career, and that's great, but I haven't always been afforded the opportunity to play characters that have been written for a Black performer. And that's something that I cherish and welcome. It's not just playing a Black role, but in this story with these people and the importance of community and culture and ancestry and family, all of those things were a part of adventures. And then, and you talk about the Lots of Soap Gang, and as younger actors compared to them, to be in the process with actors like Walter Borden and Lily Franks and Jackie Bridgerton and Barbara Baines Hopkins and Rudy Webb, like it just brought everything all together in so many ways, because it was culture, it was also ancestral, it was generational. It really covered everything, and I can go on and on and on forever about what that show meant to me. It just was the most significant professional experience I have ever had.
So well put. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me about that personal experience for you, but also what you're looking forward to this year and what you have planned for the 50th anniversary for Black Theater Workshop. There's so much to look forward to.
Yeah, there is. Thank you for having me on and to be able to talk about it. I'm excited for our public to share with us in this celebration, and it's going to be different. I can't wait until we can have our audiences back in the room with us, but in the meantime, I hope that they're going to join us on social media, on all of our virtual platforms, and I look forward to just being able to celebrate with the audiences that have been so loyal to us for 50 years.
Thank you so much, Quincy.
My pleasure. Thank you, Sarah.
That was Quincy Armorer, Artistic Director at Black Theater Workshop. Their next event is December 11th, a reading of a developing play, Sanctuary, by new BTW Artistic Associate Lydie Dubuisson. Our heroine is a teenage girl who reflects on feminism and identity in separate conversations with her sister, godmother, pastor, and God from within her church. For more on their 50th season or to donate, visit blacktheaterworkshop.ca. The company is hoping to raise $50,000 for their 50th year. I'm Sarah DeAy, and you're listening to Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM and at CKUT.ca, coming to you from my home yet again this week. Die Hard was a surprise Christmas box office hit, the story of John McClane, a New York City detective who arrives to reconcile with his estranged wife at her corporate Christmas party. Only German terrorists arrive to spoil the fun and hold everyone in the skyscraper hostage on Christmas Eve. For the past few years, Terrence Bowman has adapted and developed a live reading of Die Hard, but with an all-woman, all-Montreal cast. The reading goes virtual this year, Thursday, December 3rd at 8 p.m., but the cause is as important as ever. Donations go to the Canadian Women's Foundation, which funds programs that work to empower women and girls. And as you'll soon hear, their work is as crucial as ever. Terrence Bowman is an actor, teacher, and you might know him from his work on on-the-spot improv. We spoke earlier this week. Good evening, Terrence. Welcome back to Upstage. How have you been these past few months?
Oh, I've been hanging in there. I've been adapting and surviving and staying safe. That's been my shtick.
It's working well for you?
Yeah. So far, so good.
Excellent. I'm glad to hear that. Are things busy about now, or are you doing other things like outside of the acting realm? Like, what have things been like for you?
Things have actually been pretty busy because a lot of my acting work is I do training scenarios with McGill Medical School, and I've been doing tons of those online. I'm teaching online, teaching acting online as well, which is a whole other world. And also, like, auditions. All auditions are self-tape now, right? So, which means I have to basically shoot and edit the whole thing myself. And so that's a lot more work. But yeah, I've actually been doing a lot of work, a lot of acting-related
that's
work.
That's fantastic. And how's that learning curve? Because it's I think everybody in any profession has kind of had to adapt into some respect, right? Whether it's getting used to wearing a mask at work or safety protocols, but with acting and art, everyone's kind of had to learn how to do Zoom and how to shoot yourself. Like that's the whole learning curve that's come with it.
Yeah, for sure. And also teaching online, I find is really different. You can't really go, well, teaching acting anyways, you can't really teach classes as long as I would do live. And so I got to just like streamline everything and pack it all into a shorter amount of time. And it's been an education.
Awesome. Well, I'm glad I'm glad to hear that you're busy, and not just because of work and teaching, but also because you're bringing back your annual holiday time fundraiser for
That's
the Canadian
right.
Women's Foundation. So Die Hard, we touch on this every year just about. Why is it considered a Christmas movie?
Why is it considered a Christmas movie? Because it's a movie, well, one reason is it's a movie from 1988 that everybody still knows and knows all the lines from and knows all the character names and knows all the, there's not a lot of movies from 1988 that people are that knowledgeable about still. And that's because it's one of those that here at Christmas, you know, it's like It's a Wonderful Life. Not that many people are watching movies from the 1940s anymore, except for It's a Wonderful Life at Christmas. So it's kind of the same thing. So that's what tells me it's a Christmas movie, is because we get so many people when we used to do shows live, who would show up and like, they know all the lines, they know all the characters, they know all that. And that's because they watch it every year.
Right. And that history is why you bring it back every year. So how are you adapting for your Die Hard table read for this year?
Yeah, well, we pretty much had to do that. I was kind of keeping an eye on the situation that the year went by to see if we could possibly do one at Mainline again, but that clearly was not possible. So we've adapted a few things. There's a little more limitations to doing it online, but then there's also advantages too, in that the actors are like, you know, they're on camera and they're much closer, and they can play things kind of smaller and a little more intimately, and so that works for it.
Did you ever consider that maybe skipping it this year, that it logistically would be too tough?
No, I wanted to do one version or another of it this year. And the precedent had already been set, because there have been a number of online readings and online theater even, and online music shows, and I know some people were doing online improv shows. Actually, I did two online improv shows this year, fundraisers, for a completely different cause. So I had an idea of how just established that you could do this. So
yeah, so
there was the lead of everyone else.
And people are kind of trained to expect it now. Like, I think we've all shifted, not just our time spent with family is online, but our interactions with our favorite local theater companies and institutions have largely shifted online. Now, speaking with Terrence Bowman, who has adapted and directed Die Hard for a online table read. It's a fundraiser for the Canadian Women's Foundation, and there's a fantastic cast, which we'll get to in a moment. But it's really important this year, almost more than ever, to be talking about the cause that you support every year.
Yeah. This was one of the things that that they talked to me about. For one thing, the Canadian Women's Foundation, because we're online, decided to get a little more involved than they have been in past mm-hmm. years. So I've had meetings with them and stuff, which I hadn't done in other years. And they were telling me about, now I'd heard about this, and we've all heard about how the pandemic is affecting, you know, poorer people and less advantaged people and so on. But there's been an impact on women in particular that I don't think has really gotten a lot of media play. One of the things, is domestic violence, the threat of domestic violence, the fear of domestic violence. This has been, this is a big one. That's something that they were talking to me about right away. They had a statistic that more women have lost jobs than men in this pandemic as well. So, I really haven't heard a lot of that talked about in the media much.
Yeah, it's almost, I've heard one expression for calling it a she session, because so many women have been put in a position where they've got to choose between work and going and taking care of the kids.
Yes, that's something I can tell you totally anecdotally just from my Facebook feed.
Yeah.
The amount of women I know who have kids who have been talking about this for months now. Yeah, that's another thing for sure, yeah.
And so the money that you're raising, what does it go towards exactly?
Well, it's going towards specifically that, because one thing that they were telling me is that since the pandemic, a lot of their resources now are being directed towards the way that the pandemic is specifically hitting women's issues. So, and I asked them about that, and they said, yeah, that's where most of our resources are going right now, and we've been on this since the beginning. We do actually have a page. Die Hard's got its own page on the Canadian Women's Foundation site this year.
So it's an important cause, more important than ever, and that's why people should want to help out by taking part in the live read. Let's talk about some of the amazing women who are taking part in your cast. You have some familiar faces returning this year and some new ones, I think.
Yeah, one particular new one this year who has not done any of our readings yet. Danielle Desarmeaux is going to be playing John McClane this year, so, and that's completely new.
Mm-hmm.
From what I've seen in the rehearsals so far, I made a good call.
Yes.
That's
good news. Okay. And tell me about some of the people returning.
Some of the people returning. Well, Dina Aziz, who was McLean last year, has moved to the role of Gruber, mm-hmm. Hans Gruber.
Bad guy. Played by...
Bad guy. The main bad guy. The James Bond villain of Die Hard. Yeah. And then actually we have pretty close to the same lineup as last time, but they're all amazing. Holly Gutierrez-Franco is actually playing all of the henchmen, including Carl, the 6-foot-tall blonde German guy who was actually a Russian ballet dancer, played by a Russian ballet dancer in the movie. So she's flipping around doing all these different accents and stuff, and playing all the henchmen. That's fun. Sehar Maji is Sergeant Powell again, which is very popular in that role. Ali Maynard is the quintessential 80s sleazebag guy.
Mm-hmm.
Ari Ellis, the coke snorting collaborationist. Susan Bain is Holly, the only woman playing a woman.
Yes, John McClane's love interest.
Left anybody out, I apologize. That's just off the top of my head. It's a really talented cast, and they really come together well, they each bring their own uniqueness to it. They each have like different strengths that they bring to it, and it's and they come from slightly different backgrounds. Some of them are more strongly traditional theatrical backgrounds. Some of them are a little more comedy and improv oriented. Some of them are both. Oh, Heidi Lynn Weeks, that's it, who is our narrator, the woman that reads out all of the stage directions and stuff, which is a part of the script that I've jazzed up quite a bit. Mm-hmm. So,
right, to make it work
for... She's a character unto herself.
Yeah, because you have to kind of make some adjustments, right, to make it really transition from a feature film to a live reading.
Oh, yeah. Those action descriptions in a screenplay are just boring as hell.
Are you asking for a set donation or a suggested donation or...
We haven't put any suggested out. We have a fundraising goal of $1,000, which we want to try and hit, which would roughly be in the neighborhood of if we sold out Mainline, mm-hmm. which we did some years. So that's what we're really pushing towards. But we're not really doing suggested donations as much, because the other angle on this that I'm trying to keep in mind is this has been a great year financially for people in general.
Yeah.
So it's really more a give what you can, pay what you can kind of situation. And if somebody wants to enjoy their show and they've had a really bad year and they can't spare any money whatsoever, I understand that.
Well, Terrence, thank you so much for stopping by to talk to me about this. Congratulations on this great initiative, like in the moment where it's really needed.
Yeah, I'm happy that I was able to adapt this to not just to online, but to actually specifically addressing issues that the pandemic itself has caused. So I'm really glad to be able to take the show in that direction.
Thanks so much. Looking forward to it, Terrence. Take care.
All right. Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
That was Terrence Bowman, director of Die Hard, a live online table read with an all-female cast. The reading is Thursday, December 3rd at 8 p.m., but will be available for 24 hours after that online. Catch it at YouTube, Facebook, and Twitch via StreamYard. Visit CanadianWoman.org to donate and learn more about the cause. At the top of the hour, I mentioned that one of the shows that was to happen live this week is getting a new life. Habibi's Angels, Commission Impossible, will be presented in a live stream on Wednesday, December 2nd at 7 and Sunday, December the 6th at 3. Talisman Theatre is presenting this meta theater piece that addresses diversity and representation. Habibi is a faceless producer who wants to exploit the drive for representation by having two female writers check off all the boxes with a new bilingual show. Feminism, racism, Quebec history, love, and migration. But to what end? Are we here for the actual subject matter, or is it about exploitive tokenism? The two writers behind this piece are Kalali Dalton and Hoda Adja. Tickets are free. Visit talisman-theater.com for more information. And something else you can check out this weekend, the final piece of the Eco Anxiety series from Imago Theater, out tonight. It's A Letter from the Ocean by Caridad Savich, an ode to loss and love. It features actors Clea Miniker and Warona Setsuelo. For $5, you can rent the show from tonight until Sunday at 10. You have been listening to Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM and at CKUT.ca. Tonight, you heard Quincy Armourer of Black Theatre Workshop, Karine Kerr-Gillespie of The Metas, and Terrence Bowman of Die Hard. Thank you to all my guests, and good luck to those nominated this weekend at The Metas. Check it out this Sunday evening. You can hear past episodes of Upstage at ckut.ca under Archives. Thank you to Tamara at CKUT for making sure this show gets to air, and thank you for tuning in. I'm your host, Sarah De A. Speak with you next time on Upstage at CKUT 90.3 FM and at ckut.ca. Until next time, stay home and stay safe.
In the fight against COVID-19, we must all continue to respect public health guidelines and follow self-isolation instructions. Self-isolate if you have symptoms. Self-isolate after testing. Self-isolate if the test is positive. Self-isolate when you return from a trip. And self-isolate when you've been in contact with someone who's tested positive. Self-isolation is important. Please, take it seriously. Learn more at quebec.ca/self-isolating. A message from the gouvernement du Québec.
Plus que jamais, la santé de tous est entre nos mains. Sur mon cellulaire, l'application Alerte COVID m'avise si j'ai été en contact avec une personne déclarée positive récemment. Du bout des doigts et dans le respect de ma vie privée, je peux protéger ma santé et celle de mes proches simplement en téléchargeant l'application Alerte COVID. Rendez-vous dès maintenant sur québec.ca/alerte-covid pour obtenir plus...
December 3rd edition of Grey Matter. Tonight from Alternative Radio, we have a lecture by Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz entitled An Indigenous People's History. It was delivered in Santa Fe, New Mexico on October 11th, 2017. Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz grew up in rural Oklahoma, the daughter of a tenant farmer and part Indian mother. She has been active in the indigenous movement for more than four decades and is known for her commitment to social justice issues. She is an award-winning scholar and author of such books as An Indigenous People's History of the United States, All the Real Indians Died Off, and Loaded, A Disarming History of the Second Amendment.
The majority of U.S. Army bases on the continent were initially outposts for wars against indigenous nations. Fort Snelling, Hayes, Kearney, Leavenworth, Sill, and Riley, all named after U.S. Army officers who commanded genocidal wars. For most of the period from the U.S. War of Independence to 1890s, the sole function of the U.S. military was to kill, round up refugees, relocate and confine Native Americans and appropriate their land and resources to replace with Anglo-American settlers.